Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to OSEAMalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 150 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel, my co-host. 150 episodes. It's a nice little benchmark, that. A good milestone. So thank you. Thank you to everyone who's listened to the podcast so far. And who's supported us by subscribing, by rating and reviewing the podcast. Those things make a huge difference. I do talk about it every week because that's how we find a new, bigger audience for the podcast. So thank you to everybody who has done that. Please keep doing it. It makes a huge difference. This week, we're talking F1 GOAT, the greatest Formula One driver of all time, because we're running a contest currently on our Twitter account so that all of you lot, the TI audience, can decide who the F1 GOAT is. So we talk about that, and we've also got a comprehensive review of the BMW M3 Touring. Andrew's been driving it, and he's going to tell you all exactly what he thinks of it. So thanks everyone for tuning in and enjoy the episode. To kick things off this week, Andrew, we're going to be talking about our F1 GOAT competition, the greatest Formula One driver of all time. So we've been running this contest for, what, just over a week on our Twitter account. And the idea is to put it to the people, to put it to the TI audience. And once and for all, we can figure out who is the greatest Formula One driver of all time. Now, I think we need to make it quite clear that it's just a bit of fun, don't we? And actually, probably both of us believe that comparing drivers across generations is almost impossible, but it's a bit of fun.
It's a bit of fun, and it's also, I think it is just interesting. I mean, it's, you know, it's, you can, it's, no, it's, of course, you're not, you know, we're not going to come up with a name, and for that person to be, it's like, you know, when Rolling Stone does the greatest 100 albums of all time, every time they do it, the list is completely different.
Yeah.
So it's just, and you get this stuff called recency bias.
Yeah.
So, you know, a modern driver is just going to perform better than an otherwise equivalent older driver just because he's more front and central in people's minds now. Mm. And people, you know, are far more emotionally invested in people who, you know, they can see and are out there and doing stuff now than they were people who they could never have met and may not have been alive at the time they were doing their thing.
Yep.
So it is just a bit of fun, but I find it interesting.
Yeah.
And we are now at... well, we're recording this Monday morning, it'll go up Monday evening, so we're now, and the new poll goes up at 7 o'clock every evening, and we're now in, you know, getting towards the end of the quarterfinals. So by the end of this week, and we did actually time this in a moment of very rare organisation for the two of us, for our greatest driver, Formula One driver of all time, to be named, you know, as the Bahrain Grand Prix weekend, the first Grand Prix of 2023, gets underway.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
So it tees up the new season quite nicely, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you say. But it's interesting. I think we also have to acknowledge that we have a mostly UK audience, mostly British audience. And that's going to have some sort of impact, isn't it? So we, you and I, we chose 24 drivers.
Yeah.
And We made that decision who those 24 were. I don't think there are any real surprises in there. It's the multiple world champions, and then the sort of the one-time world champions and the very highly regarded non-champions, Moss, Villeneuve, Gilles Villeneuve. So I don't think people will really take issue with who the 24 were. We also named, although we didn't name them, we chose 8 seeded drivers. And we haven't named who those drivers are because this isn't... there will never be any consensus on who the top 8 should be. And it would be a distraction from the rest of the contest, wouldn't it? And it's important to have... Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so the reason we seeded them was simply so that you didn't have, just as an example... Lewis Hamilton and Ayrton Senna, who I think anybody would expect to see progress, come up against each other in the qualifying
round.
And one of them have to go out.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the only reason we had those 8 seeded drivers, so that they would not meet each other in the first. I mean, they're all in the first round, but they wouldn't meet each other. And in fact, one of the seeded drivers didn't go through.
That's right.
It was our first one. So Niki Lauda was not a seeded driver, but Jackie Stewart was.
Yeah,
and Niki actually beat Jackie by a reasonable margin, which really surprised me. But that may say more about me than it does about, you know. And again, maybe that's recency bias. Maybe because Niki was such a force, you know, more recently, and then kept on and became stayed very, very visible right up until really, he got sick and had to retire from the sport. So maybe that helped him. I don't know, or maybe he's a better driver.
People also admire him for coming back from his accident, don't they? That's got to be a big part of it. So we had these 24 drivers. That meant 8 qualifying rounds with 3 drivers in each. And only one could progress to the quarterfinals. Then there'd be semifinals, then a final. And this all plays out on our Twitter account because you can use the poll function and it's the best place for it because people can interact, they can comment, they can chip in. And thanks to everyone who has done so far. You've been... voting in your thousands. Actually, it's been remarkable. The first qualifying round had 2,500 votes, which is great. Yeah. And so they're drawn randomly. Apart from the seeded drivers, they're drawn randomly. And I'm just going to fly through them. The first one was Niki Lauda, Jackie Stewart, Max Verstappen. And as you say, Niki Lauda won that one, 54% of the vote. Jackie Stewart, 37%. Max Verstappen, only 9% of the vote. So that might be a British thing. It might be that he's a fantastic driver, but it's too early for him, isn't it? It's a little bit too early.
That's what a lot of people were saying. They were saying, you know, we don't doubt that he has the potential.
Yeah.
But to say that he is the greatest Formula One driver of all time.
Yeah.
When he's only won 2 championships and one of those in very highly questionable circumstances. Mm. I think people just think it's too early.
Yeah. Okay. So I agree with that. His time will come. And then the second of the 8, Michael Schumacher beat Nigel Mansell and Jochen Rindt. And then
fair enough.
Lewis Hamilton beat Emerson Fittipaldi and Nelson Piquet comfortably. That's fair enough. Then Stirling Moss beat Jack Brabham and Jenson Button.
There was a bit of controversy there, wasn't there? Because I think the Australians got a bit exercised by the fact that a bloke who had who won no Formula One World Championships beat a bloke who'd won 3.
Yeah.
And I completely understand that. I don't happen to agree with it because I think there are all sorts of reasons why Stirling didn't win more championships than he did. And obviously his career as a sort of frontline Formula One driver was an awful lot shorter than Jack's. But, you know, I completely understand that if you look at the statistics, it's a hard sell, isn't it? But, that's the great thing about these polls. People
it's
just
democratic.
Decide. Yeah, and they decide for the reasons that are important to them. There are no rules. You know, it's not like, the more championships or the more wins or fastest laps or pole positions, that should be taken into account. You don't have to take any of it into account. No. It's just the person who you think is the greatest. And the other thing, what people were saying about Stirling, which I also completely agree with, was no question he was one of the greatest drivers there's ever been, but that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for the greatest Formula One driver.
Mm.
And that's a different thing, actually.
Mm.
And they were saying that he was obviously amazing in GT cars and in sports cars, but as a Formula One driver, he was really, really good. But was he the greatest of them all? I think, I think there are question marks about that. So, interesting.
Yeah. Okay, and then Jim Clark saw off Graham Hill and Sebastian Vettel. Alan Prost saw off Gilles Villeneuve and Alberto Ascari. Juan Manuel Fangio.
So just look at that, at the, you know, particularly the Villeneuve, Alain Prost thing. Now, you think about it, you know, Villeneuve, no championships, Alain Prost, four, then it's pretty obvious. But it shows that people are thinking about this with their heads as well as their hearts. Because I think emotionally, people genuinely feel massively more connected to Gilles Villeneuve because he was such a charismatic, entertaining driver in a way that Prost, for all his undoubted success, simply wasn't.
Yeah, he's more calculated, isn't he, Prost?
Oh, yeah, he was the professor, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was, I mean, to be honest, you know, he got where he his speed derived, I'm afraid, by looking very boring on a racetrack. Because he was never the one who was sort of, you know, oversteering into oblivion and, you know, going for, you know, do or die manoeuvres to take the lead. He drove with the most incredible precision. And he always played the percentage game. And of course, over time, that's what you have to do if you want to be really, really successful. And people seem to have taken that into account to a greater extent than I thought they would. I thought that people would be voting more with their hearts than with their heads, but it seems not.
Yeah. So Fangio saw off Fernando Alonso and Mika Hakkinen. No arguments there. And then in the last of the qualifiers, Ayrton Senna comfortably trounced Kimi Raikkonen and Mario Andretti.
No surprises again, there.
Fair enough. So let me just rattle through the semi-finals, the quarter-finals, excuse me. So Lewis Hamilton saw off Alan Prost very comfortably. Michael Schumacher saw off Niki Lauda almost as comfortably. And as we record this, in the third of the quarterfinals, Jim Clark is, well, frankly, well ahead of Stirling Moss, 73% to 27%.
See, that, it doesn't surprise me that Clark is ahead of Moss, even though I would have, I think I would have voted for Moss. But it does surprise me by the margin. And then again, you know, I think that says as much about me as it does about either drivers. I just, you know, in my natural perception of things, and again, this may be coming down to, you know, Formula One rather than any other discipline within the sport, that, you know, that Jimmy Clark is, you know, however highly rated I believed he was, and I've always known that he's been regarded as a total superstar, actually the regard for him out there is even greater than I thought. So we've got one more to go, haven't we?
Yeah, well, on Moss, I think people find it hard to overlook the fact that he didn't win a championship. But actually, when you look at it, he basically gave one away one year, didn't he?
He did.
And had he not done that, had he been a champion, people probably would have backed him a little bit more, I think.
And also, you know, I don't think there's any doubt at all, his career ended when he was at his peak. I'm not sure he was actually getting better, but, you know, he was absolutely at the pinnacle. In, you know, and his career ended at the, well, I mean, the accident happened in 62, but from a Formula One point of view, his career ended at the end of the 1961 season. So we don't know, do we, what he could have gone on to do, but none of that counts.
And so we've got a tantalising final quarter final, if that makes sense, fourth quarter final. And we have to stress that these names were drawn out of a hat at random.
Yes.
We didn't manipulate this.
No.
But it does mean we've got
Apart from choosing the original 24 names and the eight seats, we didn't manipulate at all. But we got Fangio going up against Senna.
Fangio Senna. So
how do you call that?
We're going to lose a big name, a titan, in the quarterfinals. Yeah. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I don't know which way that's going to go. And actually, I think I probably have a suspicion.
Well, I don't want to clear the pitch for anyone.
No, I don't want to lead the witness.
No. But I've been wrong about this so many times. Yeah. I didn't think for a moment that Lauda would beat Jackie Stewart.
No.
I didn't think for a moment that Jim Clark would beat Stirling by the margin at which he appears to be beating him at the moment. Mm. I'm not going to say.
Mm. So,
do you know which way you would vote? And again, don't say. I don't. You know, if I had to vote, and I haven't been voting for some silly reason, there's no reason why I couldn't vote for my personal account. I don't know which way I'd go. No. I really don't.
You can make a very strong argument for either. You really can. And actually, there's no wrong way to vote. So it's going to be a close one.
Actually, I do know which way I'd vote.
Do you? Okay. Well, don't say.
Yeah.
Anyway. And so the semi-finals will kick off later this week. And the semi-finalists are Hamilton, Schumacher, Clark, and either Fangio or Senna. You can't argue with that, can you? You can't really argue with those.
No, I think ultimately, I think, well, apart from whichever one of Senna and Fangio doesn't go through. You know, people might say all about him rather than him or whatever, but I don't think that anybody could say that whichever four do make it are in any way unworthy.
Agree with that. So it's going to be fascinating to watch it play out, and it's all happening on our Twitter account. Just go search The Intercooler on Twitter. It's @_The Intercooler if you want to find us directly.
The new polls go up at 7 o'clock every evening. So if you're listening to this on Monday, then the Fangio Senna vote will go live at 7 o'clock this evening, and the first semi-final will be on Tuesday. The second semi-final will be on Wednesday. The final will go live at 7 o'clock on Thursday evening. So we will know the winner by 7 o'clock on Friday evening.
Oh, mega. And it's going to be a tight one. The final's probably going to be the tightest vote of them all, isn't it? It's mega. I'm really enjoying it. It's good fun. And thanks to everyone for chipping in with your points of view. And, you know, people really think about this deeply. And I love that. I love that. And they justify their vote, you know. So it's great. It's really good fun. It's so easy doing what we do to be obsessed with Formula One. Yes. And actually, we do talk about it a lot. We do write about it a lot because it's enormous at the moment and people love it and F1 stuff does well. But there is a world of motorsport out there. And so I think we wanted to acknowledge that today in this episode and just sort of talk about who some of the other goats are across the different disciplines. And for me, it's so black and white who, you know, my first nominee. Yeah. Of course you do. It's Sebastian Loeb. 9-time World Rally Champion. He's got far more wins than anyone. He changed the game. He won 9 on the bounce. One of the greatest motorsport competitors of all time.
How much must you hate Sebastian Loeb if you were the second best rally driver in the world at the time he won his first championship?
You're quite right. And, you know, Petter Solberg was the last person to beat him in a title race, although Loeb was very young then. Petter could have won multiple, and then the likes of Mikko Hirvonen could have won multiple championships. Jari Matti Latvala could have won multiple championships. There is a few of those guys who just didn't get a look in because they happened to arrive in the Loeb era. And then, of course, it was followed up by the bloody Ogier era.
It's amazing.
It's an amazing
The dominance those two Frenchmen have exhibited over. So when did Loeb win his first title?
04.
So we're now at 23. So, yeah. I mean, that's basically the bulk of the last 20 years, isn't it?
Yeah, so the only other champions we've had since Loeb won his first, Ott Tanak and Kalle Rovanperä. All the others have been won by a Seb from France.
Whichever one you're talking about. But there are other disciplines, aren't there? I mean, Tom Christensen.
Yeah, absolutely on my list.
Yeah? What was it? 9 Le Mans wins?
Mr. Le Mans.
Yeah, but
think about what it takes to win one Le Mans. How lucky a driver is and feels to win Le Mans once.
And also, just how great drivers, how many great drivers tried to win. Mario Andretti tried, you know, almost all his professional racing life to win. I mean, he was trying to win Le Mans in the mid-60s and he was still trying to win it in the late 90s. You know, I don't know how many times Mario did Le Mans, but it'll probably begin with a 2. Never did it. Mario Andretti, Formula One world champion. You know, regarded widely as one of the most versatile racing drivers that that there has ever been. You know, won the Formula One, won the Indy 500, didn't win Le Mans. You know, Stirling tried for years and years to win Le Mans, never did it. And I know that, you know, success breeds success, and, you know, Tom was always in, you know, really, really good cars, but you know, and also, you know, Le Mans win, it's not just you, is it? There's always the other personal people who you're sharing the car with. But even so, I do think that is an absolutely outstanding.
Is that an Audi model over your shoulder? And does that have Tom Christensen written on it somewhere?
It is an R8, or is it? No, it's an R10, I think. It's an R10 TDI. I'm not broadcasting this, so people can't see it. And it has, funnily enough, Capello Christensen and MC Nish written on it.
MC Nish. TK, Nishi and Dindo. Well, I mean, fantastic. And do you know, whenever there's a a dominant competitor in motorsport, there are people who just chirp up with, but they had the best car. Well,
yeah,
guess
but why
what?
Did they have the best car?
Well, and also, nobody wins multiple world championships or Le Mans without having had the best car.
Yeah.
Or the equal best car. No one is going to go out there with the second best car and win 5, 6, 7, 9 races or championships. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's any kind of defence, you know. Do you know, the only other one that I wanted to bring up, and I actually don't know much at all about bike racing, MotoGP, but Valentino Rossi, he's won 9 world titles. As I understand it, a couple of those were in junior categories on the smaller bikes, but he's nonetheless recognised to have 9 championships. And so 9 is a bit of a magic number in motor racing. Loeb, 9 world championships. Rossi, 9 world championships. Christensen, 9 Le Mans. It's weird.
Yeah.
People don't seem to break into the tens.
And Lewis, if not maybe everybody else, Lewis would back himself to get 9 titles, wouldn't he?
Mm. Yeah. But 10? Don't know. It just hasn't been done before. Although, as Loeb pointed out once, if Rossi's junior titles count, then why doesn't Loeb's junior World Rally Championship title? In which case, he's got 10.
Oh, there you go.
But he's not recognised as having 10, is he?
Okay, I want to mention one other person.
Go on.
Before we move on. Well, because the thing about Formula One is it only started in 1950.
Actually, I think
technically it started in 1948. And I know, I'm not going to bang on about this because I know that the sort of pre-war issue is sort of ancient history to most people. But I don't think we can have the conversation about the greatest drivers all the time without mentioning Nuvolari. I just don't think you can. Yeah. Because...
Can I just remind you, by the way, that a couple of summers ago, you spent half a day tooling around the Cotswolds in his Alfa Romeo 8C?
I did.
Does that seem real?
Yes, yes, his Mille Miglia car. Yes, it's just one of those things that, you know, you sort of... It pops up in your mind from time to time. You think, when did I dream that? And then you think, well, shit, no, I didn't. It actually happened.
Yeah, thank you, PK.
I remember I was driving that and you were chasing me in a works Aston Martin DB3S.
Yeah. Wondering how this had all happened.
Yeah, I'm still not sure, but it was... what a thing to do. But Nuvolari, I mean, you know... the reason I would... I'm not even saying that he is. But the reason I think he is a contender is because I think you have to see any driver in the context of the era in which he was doing it. And Nuvolari, in the same way that Fangio was in the 50s, he was broadly regarded as, until the Germans came into racing with the Silver Arrows in the 30s and the 40s and just literally blew everyone away with their technology. The general view was that if Nuvolari turned up, you were coming second. If Nuvolari turned up and finished, you were coming second. So that utter dominance of just pure driving talent. He was indefatigable. He was like a sort of Villeneuve in that he would just race and race and race, regardless of how knackered his car was, regardless of what position he was in. And just occasionally, I think the famous example is the 1935 German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, where the full force of the Auto Union and the Mercedes teams were there, and he was there in an elderly, outdated P3 Alfa Romeo run by Enzo Ferrari, utterly unfancied because no one could get near the Germans who had dominated. This was their second season of total domination. And on a circuit where just pure driving talent was the ultimate determining force, he did it. He beat them. I think they were so surprised. I'm not sure they had an Italian national anthem.
I think they call that hubris.
Yeah. So Nuvolari was... I mean, certainly for Enzo Ferrari, who knew a bit, and okay, you can't really... His life didn't sort of, you know, take into account anybody who lived after 1988, but he always said that Nuvolari was the greatest driver he ever saw.
Mm.
And I'd say, you know, Ferrari said an awful lot of stuff which I don't, you know, particularly take that seriously. But when he says something like that, I kind of take that seriously. So, yeah. So that's it.
Wow, mega. Okay. Well, let's get back to Formula
1. I just wonder whether people, anybody listening to this, if you want to find a way of telling us who you think is the greatest driver who never raced in Formula 1, or who's not primarily known for racing in Formula 1.
Yeah.
Whatever genre, whatever era, whatever, get in touch with us on, you know, on Twitter, or leave some comment somewhere, or, you know, just let us know who you think is the greatest driver of all time, not to be most famous for racing in Formula 1.
Mm. What's great about this is that we'll have people messaging saying, such and such won 14 world championships in some bizarre discipline that, you know, would never come to mind. And that's great. We're not necessarily abreast of all that stuff. So if you think someone deserves credit and we've not given it to them here, get in touch. Let us know.
I can remember just on that exact point, asking Derek Warwick what his greatest race ever was, yeah, expecting him to say it was, you know, some Grand Prix which he nearly won or whatever. And he nominated a Super Stocks race that he did in the 1970s, when he was barely out of short trousers I think Superstocks are like on a dirt track or something, isn't it? And in those worlds, all those myriad little different niche corners of motorsport, there will be the heroes. There will be the most amazing people that no one's ever heard of, because the particular thing they did wasn't played out on a world stage.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Oh, tons of those. Yeah. So let's bring it back to Formula One, because it's race week. The Bahrain Grand Prix this weekend kicks off the 2023 Formula One season.
Yes.
We've had winter testing at Bahrain, 3 days of it. We don't need to pore over all of it. But I was just so pleased to see Formula One cars running around a circuit again, and I can't wait for this weekend's Grand Prix. So winter testing, Red Bull look pretty ominous. That's a fast car. It looks really sweet to drive. But it was always going to be, wasn't it? They weren't going to make any radical changes to the best car from last season. The Ferraris look competitive, although I think there is a question mark over their tyre wear over a stint. And the Mercedes, well, they're in a better place than they were at this point last season.
Yeah.
I suspect they still have work to do to unlock that car.
Okay. I suspect they're playing a blinder.
Do you think so?
I do.
Do you really think so?
Well, Toto said something, didn't he, during the course of the week? He said, we may have... I mean, the other thing with all these things, it's all just mind games. Nobody knows.
No.
Nobody really knows, because nobody knows how hard the drivers are trying. Nobody knows what fuel loads they're on. Nobody knows what they're out there for. You know, there's a big difference between doing an installation lap and doing a quality lap. Mm. My sense is that of the three big teams, so Red Bull, Ferrari and Mercedes, I think Ferrari probably have the most to worry about. Ferrari always win winter testing, don't they? They always do that. They're always the quickest. And we're always going, oh, bloody hell, Ferrari look amazing. And then somehow something goes wrong during the course of the season.
Mm.
That hasn't really happened. I mean, if anyone's won winter testing, it's Red Bull.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
But, you know, don't forget that last year's Mercedes, despite, you know, the worst possible start to the season, was a race-winning car. It was fully competitive. And now, having had the entire winter to think about how to improve that package and to sort of perfect the podless design, I'm not saying they're going to be... I'm not saying for a moment that they're going to disappear as they have done in previous seasons, but I think they will be at Red Bull from the start.
Mm, God, I do. Well, I hope so. They're definitely in better shape. There's no question.
Yeah, definitely better shape. And I think that Ferrari, maybe not in qualifying, but over a race distance, I think Ferrari might struggle. But I don't know. Who knows?
We don't know. We don't know. That's why the start this time of the season is so
this
exciting.
This time next week, I'm going to come back on this podcast and just, you know, just chew humble pie and say, I can't believe it, how wrong I got it when Sainz and Leclerc have a 1-2 and, you know, everybody else is nowhere.
But this is why it's great, because we have first qualifying session, then the first race, and then all the BS stops, all the hot takes stop, because we finally know what the order is. It's tantalising.
And the other good thing, which I like, I'm not particularly, you know, saying anything about Bahrain, the country or the state, but the fact that the first Grand Prix is not in Australia, I think, is a good thing, because Melbourne's always been a very poor form indicator.
Mm.
Certain cars just go well at Melbourne, which may not go, and it doesn't mean they're going to go well for the rest of the season, and vice versa. Whereas I think Bahrain's a pretty good indicator of form.
It's a fairly standard track, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly a much better indicator of form. So I think that if a team has a clear advantage, you'll see it this weekend. I am, despite the fact that last year was dull as ditch water, I'm absurdly excited. Somehow over the winter, I just managed to, having signed off the season, thinking, well, I might not bother with that again. By the time the new one comes around, I'm just itching.
Chomping, yeah. Yeah, I am too.
I can't wait.
Let's just hope it's not a steamroller by the Red Bulls again.
I really don't think it will be.
So, what was I going to bring up? Oh, yes, the other teams that look good. So, I mean, again, is it grandstanding? Is it genuine? But yeah, the Aston looked racy at times, particularly with Alonso in it. The Alfa at times, the Alfa Romeo looked quick. others, I mean, Williams have clearly made a step forward. McLaren, though.
Yeah. I thought, when we did our season preview, I was the idiot who was going, oh, McLaren, they've got a really kick-ass driver lineup now. Alpine, who are their big rival for best of the rest, clearly, having lost Alonso and got Gasly, has gone backwards from the point of view of driver. And they seem to be the team with all the work to do. But, yeah, as you say, I mean, McLaren seem to be struggling a bit. But are they? Are they really?
Well, let's revisit it in a week. Okay, let's leave motorsport behind because there's a car I want to talk about.
Go on.
You've been knocking about in it for a few days, a week maybe. First of all, have you come to terms with the way the BMW M3 Touring looks?
Only because it was black.
Yeah, it's interesting what a difference it makes, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't see the grille. I think the BMW M3 Touring, I thought it looked really good. And I put something on to this effect on Twitter and I got absolutely roasted for it. Yeah. But in black, where you can't see the grille, and particularly with the Touring bodywork, I do think it looks good. I really do. I'd be, happy to tool about in one. And I wouldn't, want to have a sort of brown paper bag over my head just in case somebody recognised me. It's not gorgeous. It's not, an iconic piece of car design, but I think it looks good.
And it looks great
in
the
colour, which allows you to completely conceal the grille.
Yeah. But it looks great from the rear.
Yeah.
It's squat. It's muscular.
Yeah.
We have been waiting actually decades for this car. I mean, first M3 Touring was what, 80? Sorry, first M3 was 86, I think. Yeah, 36 years.
So they've never done a Touring. And, if you wanted a fast BMW Touring, you had to go to Alpina to get one.
But let's just make this point, because it's badged an M3 Touring, so it is an M3 Touring. But the M3 has changed a lot over the years, hasn't it? Okay,
yeah.
And to illustrate, this M3 Touring is wider and longer than the E39 M5. It's also wider than the E60 M5. The V10 one. So is it really an M3? Because, it's a big car. What is it, 1,900 kilograms as well?
Best part of with the four-wheel drive and the Touring bodywork, yeah. It's a heavy car.
It's a chunky thing.
I think it's 18-something.
I think it's 1865,
yeah.
I need to get it on some scales. But, in many ways, the M2 is the new M3.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
And so what, the M3 has become a bit more like an M5.
Yes.
So it's worth saying that. But what did you think of it then?
I did 1,000 miles in it in 3 days. Not because I set out to do that, but because that's what I happened to be doing over those days. And I was really, really sad to see the back of it. Okay, the only thing that I would have changed on the car that I had, it had the optional carbon seats in it, which
lots
I really,
of people
really
don't get
bother
one
with.
Of those. Yeah.
No, well, I'm one of them. Yeah. But other than that, oh my goodness, it just worked so well, and it's so much nicer. It's so much cleverer a car than an M4. The M4 is a coupe, so it's a lot less practical. I don't think it looks as good. You have the compromise to it. But even over the M3 saloon, I love the Touring because obviously there's an additional practicality component. But also, to me, there's almost a conceptual thing. It's not writing quite so big a check in your head because it's the estate car.
Yeah.
And so your expectations of it are lower and therefore easier for the car to meet. And, it's not the last word in sort of pin sharp steer it on the throttle handling response, because it weighs what it weighs and it's that kind of car. And in an M4, that's why you and I always go on about, oh, we'd just much rather drive an M2 comp or, you know, than an M4, because it just feels, you know, more delicate, more responsive, you know, more the way we want a driver's car to be. But when you're actually talking about a 3 Series Touring, the fact that it's not like that is far more excusable, particularly because you can stick your dog and your luggage in the back of it. And I just, for a car to live with, rather than, you know, simply looking at it in terms of, you know, what it's like in on the roads, sorts of roads that most people never drive on or very rarely drive on, like deserted mountain roads or racetrack, but to live with day in, day out, going through towns, up and down motorways, on decent roads as well, I just thought it was such a, it's a pragmatic car, but just a really, really sensible, clever, well-conceived, well-executed design, which just ticked all the boxes I wanted a car like that to tick, apart from the fact that I haven't got £88,000 to spend on one. It's so expensive.
88 grand. And what was your spec up to? Do you know off the top
of
your head?
Well, with the carbon brakes and the carbon seats, it would have been a six-figure car.
It's a six-figure car.
An early six for a, three series. £100,000 three series. And you know, and I think the point I would seek to make is that for 98% of the people, 98% of the time, an M340i Touring, which still has 370 horsepower and will get you to 60 in 400 bit seconds, is probably a better car. And it costs 30 grand less. I think it's 57, 58. I think the M3 Touring is 88 basic. And I think an M340i is like 57, 58 basic.
That's a lot, isn't it?
But it doesn't look that good. It doesn't look as good as the M3 Touring because it doesn't have the, you know, the pumped up bodywork and that sort of thing, and ultimately it won't be as good to drive. But it's, you know, I really, really liked it. I couldn't remember when I was last so sad to see an M car go.
Wow.
It's interesting. I tweeted something about this, and Chris Harris, who's got an M3 Touring at the moment and an M5 CS, came back and said that, you know, that of the two, he preferred the M5. And he said he wasn't that knocked out by the amount of road noise that you got from the M3 Touring, which didn't particularly bother me. But, I mean, it does go to show, doesn't it, that there are, you know, and with the M2 comp that's gone and hopefully the one that's coming, which we'll be reviewing in the next couple of weeks or so, you know, if that sets similar standards, you know, it's great, isn't it? Because we have been so sort of worried about the direction that M has been going in for such a long time that there are actually some really good M cars out at the moment.
Oh, fantastic. And they somehow work with the weight. These are heavy cars, but they work with that weight. It is clever. So what about the ride? Were you happy with the way the M3 Touring rides?
Yeah, it was good
not
enough.
Too firm.
Again, it would have been, I would have been far more comfortable. I think an M3 Touring on standard seats, I think actually you'd regard the riders for that kind of car as being good. Not great, but more than good enough. It certainly wouldn't be. Because, and yeah, I'm very sensitive to these things, and I always have been. It's not just because I'm old. I hate cars that just, because, you know, a fine handling car, you can really appreciate, you know, well, not all the time, but a poor riding car, you feel every time you get into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I suspect on the standard seat, I mean, even with the carbon seats, you know, I did, you know, three journeys, each of many hundreds of miles on consecutive days, and was very happy to do so.
Mm. Yeah. And presumably because it's a Touring and quite a different car, the automatic gearbox bothered you less than it would in an M4?
It's amazing. It didn't bother me at all. You see, and that's the thing. That's the sort of the conceptual thing. You know, it really, really winds me up in an M4.
Yeah,
it does.
Those slightly slurred gear shifts.
Yeah, and if I'm honest with you, I don't think I claw thought about it because I'm professionally required to. But personally, there wasn't a moment when I was sitting there thinking, "Oh, come on, give us a shift, give us a shift." And again, because in my head, I'm driving a 3 Series estate.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting car. It took them a bloody long time to do it.
Why didn't they do it sooner?
I know, when the car was still little, still lightish. But they built an E46, a one-off prototype. Didn't do anything with it.
Didn't do anything with it. And, you know, and now they've just finally decided to do it just at the time when, you know, estates couldn't be further from fashion. More, they couldn't be more out of fashion.
Yeah, so people want SUVs, don't they?
Yeah. I really hope that it flies, because that means they might do some more. It's a really, really good car, and it's a really great BMW M car. I think the world's a better place for it.
We'll have to wait. They're never going to tell us exactly how well it does, but is it just one of those cars that people like us get all worked up about and actually buyers aren't interested in because they want an SUV?
I think what will happen is that if they want a practical car, they'll get an SUV, and if they want a fast car, they'll get an M4. Because, you know, an M4 is, well, I think, I'm trying to climb inside an M4 buyer's head. I think they'll think it looks cooler. I think they'll think that it projects a more racy image of them. And I think those things are more important. And, if, you know, if they want to go anywhere with their family or with their dog, they've probably got, you know, an X5, they'll do that in instead.
So the M3 Touring is just the first of a handful of really significant performance cars that we're going to be reviewing soon across the TI channels, app, website, social media, on this podcast. We've got some big stuff coming soon. Aston Martin Valkyrie. Yep. Henry's been driving that for us. I think it's a week today maybe that we get to publish our story on that car. BMW M2, as you've mentioned. So there's some big stuff coming. I guess it's because spring comes around, the weather improves, and all the tasty cars come out again. It's great. I love this time of year. So stay tuned to all our channels, because there's some really, really important reviews coming soon. Okay, we've got a listener question coming up. It's a good one. And actually, it's well-timed, because I have been talking to some people who know about this topic. And so I'd be interested to get your point of view, but I've got a few thoughts of my own. But before we do the listener question, let me just remind you all to go and rate and review the podcast. It's really important, takes you no time at all. But also follow or subscribe if you're probably using Apple Podcasts, you might be using Spotify. They will both have a little follow or subscribe button. Just hit that. It's really important. That's how we find new listeners. That's how the podcast apps push our podcast. The more of you do that, the more we get pushed.
And it's also how you make sure you don't miss an episode. I mean, I subscribe to various podcasts because of the way my brain works, and because I'm just busy all the time, I'll just miss episodes.
It's the best way. Just follow, subscribe. So the listener question comes from Ross G. It's an interesting one. Is it weird, he asks, that we still trim car interiors with the skin of dead cows? Why do we need mammal skin in our cars? Is it weird in this day and age? Interested to get your thoughts, but I've got some good insight here.
Is it weird that we choose to cover our feet in the skin of dead cows? I think it probably is. but we've been doing it for years and years and years, and I think, you know, in 50 years from now, then we probably won't be. I think we're in one of those transition phases. It's just one of those things that we become so habitualised, if that's even a word. We are so used to doing it, we don't question it. But I think the way the world is going, and I'm not making any judgments here as to whether it should or it shouldn't, I think it will be increasingly difficult to do that. I was speaking to one of the Bentley designers. I went to talk to them about the Bacalar. You remember that sort of concept car that they made a very, very small number of? And I was talking to one of their interior designers, and I asked her if they'd done a genuinely vegan interior, and if they'd been asked for a genuinely vegan interior. And she said that they had tried and they had been asked. But the problem is finding materials that will pass all the tests, because, you know, you can't just, you know, trim an interior in something that you like the look of, because, you know, it's got to last the lifetime of the car. And it's got to go, you know, it can't get sun damaged. You can't have holes materializing it. It can't just sort of wear through. And it has to meet, you know, the brand standards and everything else that you expect from the car. And she was saying, she wasn't saying it can't be done. She was saying it's really, really difficult. And we haven't found a way of doing it yet.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. And so I had a conversation with a couple of chaps from Bridge of Weir. It's a tannery, so a leather place up in Scotland. And they provide really good quality leather to Land Rover for the Range Rover, but also smaller companies as well. Singer uses Bridge of Weir leather in its restoration.
Aston Martin definitely have. I don't know if they still do.
Yeah, so they're one of the top suppliers, particularly to UK
Absolutely.
Car companies.
Yeah.
Now, let's get this clear. They obviously are partial. They have an interest. You know, they are going to big up the use of leather in cars, aren't they? They're not about to say, do you know what, it's not the right stuff. But it was interesting to get their point of view, nonetheless, on why leather is still a good material to use. It's really important to say that all their hides, and I think this is probably true across the board in the car industry, all those hides come from cows that are being reared for beef or for milk, for dairy. So, and these are cows that are being slaughtered anyway. They would never, they say, kill a cow just for its hide. So it's actually a byproduct of other industries. Yeah. And the point to make is that if the car industry stopped using leather tomorrow, not a single cow would be spared its fate. Because these cows are not being slaughtered just for their hides. And if these cows are being killed, and they are, for beef or for dairy, they've come to the end of their life, it's better that we use every part that we can, isn't it? Rather than just chucking bits of these dead cows away. And so leather was used initially in the early days of the car because a lot of cars were open to the elements.
Yes.
And it was really the only material that they had. It was waterproof, it was wiped down, it was hard wearing. And so it became the obvious choice. And then over time, actually, it became associated with luxury, didn't it, leather?
Yeah, but I mean, initially, back in the early days, I mean, for instance, I know that if you're being really, really posh, you have cloth upholstery.
Right.
So the Bentley, what do they call it, state limousine, doesn't have a leather interior.
Mm.
And it's not because they're trying to be environmentally friendly. It's because leather was... And you also used to get... do you know what I mean by a Sedanka Deville bodywork?
No.
So Sedanka Deville is where the owner and his or her other half sit in the back undercover, and the poor sod up front.
Yeah, he's open.
He's got the open top. And so the chauffeur would sit on leather because he gets soaked, and in the back they'd have cloth because that wasn't the problem.
Isn't it? Yeah.
So leather was seen to be a pragmatic, durable, hardy, you know, wipe clean material, which you used because it probably was cheaper than, you know, doing proper upholstery. Yeah.
And so the point the Bridge of Weir chats made is that leather is actually still the best option because leather wicks, it breathes. And there's no man-made waterproof material that breathes, that wicks like that, that takes moisture away from your skin. Also, it's still wipe clean. It's still waterproof. It's very tough. It's very durable. It can also, at the end of the car's life, it can be recycled or disposed of. Now, the alternative that's often being trumpeted these days is called vegan leather, which is actually just a very clever bit of marketing because it's plastic. It's plastic leather. It's not vegan leather. It's plastic. So it's derived still from crude oil, you know, and that's, come on, we're supposed to be moving away from that stuff, aren't we? And vegan leather cannot be disposed of in the same way. And basically, leather is like wood. It's one of these amazing natural materials that we just can't better ourselves, at least not on any great scale. And so, for all these reasons, leather remains a very good option for car interiors. Now, it should be said that there are more and more people out there who clearly, and for good reason, just don't want animal skin in their cars. Mm. And that's fine. I actually totally understand that. And car makers are duty-bound to offer a good alternative. But for everyone else, leather probably remains the most suitable material.
Yeah.
There
Could
you
be the question.
All right. Well, there you go, Ross G. Thanks for sending that question across. Keep sending your questions in because we like ending the podcast with them. And we'll do it again next week when we will have a better idea of what the 2023 Formula One season is going to deliver.
And who the greatest F1 driver of all time is.
Oh, yes, we will know that as well, won't we?
Yeah.
God, there's all sorts going on. There we go. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week.
Cheers. Bye.
deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.